Our next case is 2020-549, the State of Ohio versus Albert Jarvis. The appellant, Ms. Bennington.
Chief Justice O'Connor, fellow justices, may it please the court. My name is Taylor Bennington. I'm with the Muskegon County Prosecutor's Office on behalf of appellant State of Ohio. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for amicus and then reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Today, we're asking this court to resolve a conflict that exists among the appellate districts on whether Ohio's Senate Bill 231, which established a violent offender database, violates Section 28, Article 2 of the Ohio Constitution. Your Honors, I would reaffirm what my colleague from Butler County has said this morning, and given the fact that the issues are identical, I'm not going to repeat the argument made by him, but I would like to highlight the key holdings I believe are dispositive of the issue today. The standard for determining whether a statute's retroactive application violates the retroactivity clause has already been established by this court. We're not asking this court to create a new standard. We're simply asking that the standard be applied to Sierra's law. And the question is whether Sierra's law is substantive or remedial in nature. According to this court, a substantive statute for our purposes is one that imposes new or additional burdens, duties, obligations, or liabilities as to a past transaction. And we don't have that here because the commission of a felony is not the type of transaction that creates a reasonable expectation of finality. This court has consistently held that felons have no reasonable right to expect that their conduct will never thereafter be made the subject of legislation. So at the time Mr. Jarvis committed the offense of kidnapping, he had no reasonable expectation of finality with respect to the absence of any post-conviction regulation. And as such, retroactive application of the violent offender enrollment statute does not create a new burden in the constitutional sense. I would further like to note and remind the court the details of how in every measure, whether it's duration, frequency, or scope, Sierra's law is less onerous than even Megan's law, which this court found to be remedial and upheld in Ferguson. And so, Your Honors, in applying the tests that this court has set forth and repeatedly used in Matz, Cook, Ferguson, and White, Sierra's law is remedial and does not violate the Ohio Constitution when retroactively applied. Unless there are any new questions, I would defer to Mr. Kearney at this point.
Mr. Kearney.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, we'll repeat everything we said in the first case, but to continue that conversation, I haven't really heard anything concrete that rebuts the notion that their entire view depends on trying to substitute the Ferguson dissent for the Ferguson majority. And again, that's not consistent with not only what Williams said, where Williams said, look, this statute crosses the line, we're not moving the line, but also the particular things they pointed to are primarily things that were features already in Megan's and Cook. One of the things, and I apologize for blurring cases, but since it's all the public defender on the other side, I hope it's okay. But one of the things counsel said was that, well, in the Megan's Law cases, there was always an incremental move from Cook to Ferguson or Ferguson to Williams. Well, that's not true. When Cook came online, what had been the law in 1968 was very minimal. Virtually everything in Cook was brand new duties to come in and register. And this court said that was okay. And so to say that's not okay anymore would call Cook and Ferguson into question. There's no way to rule for them without overruling Cook and Ferguson. And in particular, I know in both briefs, in Jarvis and Hubbard, they repeatedly cite the Ferguson dissent. And the Williams court did not substitute the dissent for the majority. It reaffirmed the majority. And the things that it said crossed the line were things like the duration, frequency, and scope. At most, the one or two things like tattoos and scars are a little different now, and admittedly are closer to Adam Walsh, but that doesn't mean we're going into an entire pre-sentencing report. It just means you show us what identifying characteristics you have, like in a photo. And again, a photo is already on the DRC website. There's nothing new about that. But if for some reason a particular offender does think that that is going to harm him, there is a provision in this, and I want to stress, this is distinct from the rebuttable presumption on the front end, where you can get out of the statute entirely if you're not the principal offender. But separately, you can go to a court at any time during your 10-year period, and if you meet the requisite showing, have that information in the sheriff's office be declared no longer public, even the stuff that is public now. So there is already a remedy built in for that. But overall, the bright line rule has always been this idea that the expectation of finality that we apply for civil things and retroactivity doesn't apply to felonies. To the extent that there's some tension in Williams about matter of degree versus the bright line approach, there are a couple of answers to that. The most important is that you don't have to work out whatever analytical glitches there are in Williams. You don't have to change today because we know the outcome of the statute upheld in Ferguson was more burdensome than here. And as long as the outcome here is an easier case, you don't have to smooth that out. But if you do want to smooth that out, the answer is that Williams imported some notions from the ex post facto clause. The court openly cited the Kennedy federal case, Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez, which has a matter of degree seven-factor test. Well, first, White already got that back on track by not citing Williams and by citing Ferguson. Second, if somebody has a matter of degree case they want to bring, they can just bring an ex post facto challenge, just like they can bring an equal protection or a due process challenge. I do want to note, as far as those long-term confined, that's not this case. Jarvis or Hubbard are not in that category. They're not bringing that challenge. The court shouldn't reach out to challenges not brought. But ex post facto should stay in its own box. Someone can always bring an ex post facto challenge. But at best, if you need to harmonize them, I believe the way Justice DeWine's opinion on the First District and Caldwell did it was just right. And it said, perhaps there is at the outer limit some idea where something is so punitive that it does trigger your expectation interest because you expect to face perhaps registration duties, but you don't expect to be punished. So if you're punished, that exceeds expectation. But again, nothing about these registration duties, annual for 10 years, is easily softer than what's upheld in Ferguson. So I don't see how you can say this is more onerous unless you say, well, it's not onerous to do it to a child molester, but it is onerous to do it to a murderer or kidnapper. I don't see what the basis for that is. This court has never said that the crime that was the basis changes the analysis. The court only looked at the duration, frequency, scope, residency, the push notifications, all of those factors, which again are either lesser or at most the same, other than the tattoos. If the court finds a reason to sever that, fine, we don't think there's any reason to. We don't think you have a finality interest in the tattoos you had of the day of your murder versus new tattoos you've gotten today. That's basic identification. And again, that's only kept with the sheriff, and you can petition to have that removed from the public domain. I see there's still a lot of time left, so I'll save for a longer rebuttal for Ms. Bennington and not use up my time as usual, unless there are further questions. But again, we ask the court to uphold this law because there is no way to strike it down without taking out the Megan's regime for decades and decades. And this court did not do that in Williams, and it certainly should not do that today.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kearney. Mr. Hardwick.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court. I'm going to start briefly on the procedural issue unique to this case, and I understand why this court would want to give the state the opportunity to brief the issue, but there is no certified conflict exception to the forfeiture doctrine. In the one-page argument that the state filed in the Court of Appeals, they argued one thing, and that's that the statute wasn't retroactive because it applied to convictions that occurred after the effective date of the statute. That's it. In this case, they are arguing now that it is retroactive, but it's constitutionally retroactive. And I ask this court to do one of two things: either dismiss this case as improvidently allowed and resolve the conflict in my colleague's case, the Hubbard case, or if this court decides it needs to resolve the conflict, then it needs to take the next step and say, how does that legal question apply to this case? And even if this court resolves the conflict in favor of the state, this court should nevertheless affirm because, again, the state's one-page argument on a different, making a completely different argument in the Court of Appeals did not preserve the argument they are making in this court. But as to the merits, I want to go briefly. The one thing that's different about the Cook, Ferguson, and Williams trilogy that's different, that is different from the other cases, is that if they're the only cases that apply the retroactivity doctrine to the question of, to the remedial substantive doctrine, to when does something become enough punishment enough that it passes from remedial to be punishment. And well, cases like Matz addressed, that didn't address whether a person had a entitlement to recover funds from someone who'd done them criminal wrong. It only addressed the means to recovery. And White, again, didn't create a new right or didn't take away a right, a substantive right, to just say, well, how do we address your right to appropriate voir dire, to a lawful voir dire, and talk about the procedure for reaching that. I also disagree strongly, with my friend on the other side. We don't ask this court to overrule Cook or Ferguson. And my colleague talked about how Adam Walshaft wasn't the ceiling for substantive law, but wasn't the floor. Ferguson was the ceiling for what is remedial. This court, when it issued Williams, said, look, Ferguson was a close call, but now you've made things even worse and put all doubt. And this court said that all doubt has now been removed. The doubt has been removed. That's because Ferguson was the ceiling for what the state can get away with and still call it remedial.
You know, if that's true, I mean, is this scheme really more onerous than the one in Ferguson? I mean, when I look at it, it seems to me that if I had to comply with one or the other, I would rather comply with the one here than the one in Ferguson.
Well, it works in a number of ways. First of all, unlike Ferguson, this is solely offense-based. The system under Megan's law was, unless there was a finding that you were dangerous, your registration ended after 10 years, full stop. Nothing happened after. You were done after 10 years. And the only way you went above 10 years was a finding of dangerousness. That doesn't happen here. You have to provide additional information to the state that you did not have to provide before. This is extendable for life. Extendable for life.
There's none of the community notification things and there's other things, right, though?
I mean, there's no mandatory community notification, but I know from other cases I've dealt with, sheriffs, at least with sex offender laws, have sometimes gratuitously issued community notification just because they want to. There's nothing in the statute that stops a sheriff from doing community notification if they want to. And that does happen in some sex offender registration cases as well. And that when the state wrote in the brief that this, and my friend and I wrote in the brief that this isn't a public record, it is expressly a public record, unlike the arson case, which says this is not a public record. This is a public record. And I can't imagine any other situation where you just say just because something isn't affirmatively required to be on the internet, it's not public. That's just not the way public records work. Even small things like my friend on the other side said, well, the photograph isn't anything new because that's on DRC's website. Well, that's not true after post-release, after your supervision is done, DRC takes your photos down. DRC takes all your information off of their website once you get off supervision. And they do that very intentionally because they want you to have a chance to reintegrate into society. They found that people were using that database to not give people apartments, to not give people jobs. So Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections very admirably now takes down that information. You cannot find someone's picture on DRC's website if they are no longer under supervision. And I do think it's important to note how this is extendable. This is extendable upon any violation of post-release control, any violation, and it's mandatory on motion of the prosecutor. If you are 1 minute late on your curfew one day, the prosecutor can get you extended indefinitely. And then, yes, you can ask after 5 years, you can ask to be taken off, but there is nothing that requires a judge to ever take you off. There is no requirement. A judge can, at his or her own whim, deny a motion without explanation. And as long as they don't express, and the only way that you may be able to challenge a judge's decision to deny that motion is if the judge expressly gave some improper reason, like, I'm denying your motion because of your race or something along that way. As long as the judge doesn't say that,
counsel, is there a hearing required when the prosecutor motions to extend?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you do get a hearing. The problem is, on our side, it's utterly standardless. There are some things that prevent the judge from taking you off the list, but there is, under no circumstances is a judge required to take you off the list. None.
No, I'm talking about the hearing when the prosecutor moves for a minor violation of probation to extend the registration requirements.
Yes, you do get a hearing, but by statute, the statute states that if the judge finds a violation, the judge must extend the time. The judge has no discretion not to. I know this court in other cases has dealt with issues, what's a technical violation, what's not. There is no technical violation exception to this. It's any violation of your community control, your post-release control. And again, 1 minute, one day late on your, when you've been under post-release control for 4 years and 364 days, and you have it extended indefinitely to life at the judge's whim.
Excuse me, Mr. Hardwick, I think I saw something in the statute that there can only be two requests made in a 5 year period.
Yes, for some reason I thought it was only one every 5 years. My recollection is one every 5 years. You have to wait 5 years if you have it denied, you have to wait 5 years.
And that's to, what does that apply to?
That applies if you've committed that one your one post-release control violation, has the judge extended indefinitely, you can come back every 5 years and ask the judge, okay, let me off now. And the other thing about that is you have to be able to show that you've been able to pay off all your restitution, so that if you can't afford to pay off your fines, you're on it for life. You're mandatory. The judge has no discretion. If you can't afford to pay off your fines, you are on this list for life. And I don't understand how my friends on the other side have never shown how there's a public safety interest in keeping someone on the list just because they can't afford to pay off their fines. But that's what this does. That's also part of why this is punishment. I also want to address one of the factors that this court, that I know the first district addressed in Caldwell, where it talked about how, well, this is only a quote short prison term because it's a year, it's an F5. Just a year in prison is a life-changing event. It can be life-destroying. People lose custody of their children, they lose their jobs, they lose their homes, if it was the last year, depending on the prison they've gone to, they could have probably more than a 75% chance of getting COVID. A year in prison is not a short time. It is a long time. Yes, it's not as long as people get for other offenses, but it is still a very long time to have your rights taken away. I also want to say, friend of the side talked about this, chance to rebut, for someone in prison, the chance to rebut the presumption of that they were the principal offender is the same as what happened in Cook. Well, that's wrong, because in Cook, you were a sexually oriented offender unless before you left prison, the state took an affirmative step to ask for a hearing to make you a sexual predator, to have a judge designate you as a sexual predator. Nothing additional happened. You didn't lose any rights by not filing anything before you left. But here, DRC, and as Amika says, sometimes it's 2 days before they leave. You get notified. You have zero chance to ask to be left off this, to take it off this registry. Zero chance to ask that you're not a principal offender. Because all the statute says is a reasonable time. And there's also going to be times since I've had clients who get out who find out the morning of that they're leaving prison. They didn't know the day before. They win something on appeal. Their sentence gets shorter. Well, then they get no notice at all, and they have no chance to take themselves off.
Counsel, if they won something on appeal, chances are this isn't going to apply to them.
Well, if they've had their prison term get shortened, or where they say maybe a gun spec gets thrown out, and now they've already served their time of their underlying offense. So the wins on appeals tend to be more. We rarely get someone's conviction completely vacated. It's more frequent that they have part of their sentence vacated and they get sent out.
So, counsel, are you saying if they have a very short window of time once they are released from prison? And they don't have adequate time then, for example, the public defender or even private counsel to address this with the court, they automatically are required to register.
Correct. If they have zero time after release, once they are released, it's too late.
Okay.
Once they walk out of prison date, it's too late.
All right. It's too late to petition the court for a hearing?
Yes. To ask for a hearing on whether they were not the principal offender.
The court does not have any discretion to hold a hearing and make a determination.
I see none in the statute. Maybe my friend on the other side will make that concession. My guess is if they didn't make that concession here and I tried to argue, they'd argue it was jurisdictional. Because I see nothing. The statute says the motion has to be made before they leave prison. And I don't see any exception to that in the statute. This is a punitive statute. Unless there are any other questions, I just want to finish with saying that Williams, make sure I get my floor and my ceiling analogy right. Williams is not the floor for what is punitive. Ferguson is the ceiling for what is remedial. Williams did leave Ferguson in place, but Williams made it clear that Ferguson was right on the cusp. And you can look at it from a lawyer's practical point of view, you can look at it and say that, okay, now Ferguson was 4-3 and it said that this is barely constitutional. They pushed it further, but we can go more than just the lawyers looking at it and counting votes and saying, no, the majority in Williams said that Ferguson was a close call. And just as the General Assembly went farther when they dealt with, when they created Adam Walsh Act, they stepped beyond Ferguson when they created the Violent Offender Registry. This is now punitive, and when something is punitive, it is substantive, and it can't be imposed retroactively. And I ask this court to either dismiss the certified conflict as improvidently allowed, or to affirm the decision of the Fifth District, either because we win on the merits, or because even if this court rules on the merits for the state forfeited the issue and therefore is not entitled to relief in this court. This court should not permit the state to use briefing in this court as a substitute to file, as a substitute to filing a proper brief and argument in the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, there's 6 minutes and 42 seconds. Who will do the rebuttal? Looks like Ms. Bennington.
I believe Ms. Bennington is rebutting, but she does seem to be frozen.
Why don't you take a stab at it, Mr. Curry?
So if you want, and if she pops back up, I will gladly yield the floor right back to her. But she does seem frozen. First, as to the forfeiture issue, that obviously is best answered by the prosecutor. But I will say this, that the idea that something is simply not retroactive versus saying, oh, it is retroactive, but it's the permissible kind of retroactivity, is something this court in Doe v. Ronan has equated before. And it's basically two ways of saying the same thing, that if in Doe, the court looked at a case where the new obligation was for someone to lose their teaching job based on a decades old marijuana possession conviction. And this court said, because it's a future a future loss of something based on a past thing, that doesn't mean it's actually imposing a past duty. It's simply a future consequence. In that case, they called it not retroactive at all. The difference between calling something not retroactive or calling something permissibly retroactive is merely a semantic difference. So whether it's one pages or 20 pages, the brief covered the same concept. I see Ms. Bennington is back, so I'm happy to hand it to her back or say something quickly as Ms. Bennington.
Well, before you relinquish, Mr. Kearney, what do you say to the one of the last points that Mr. Hardwick made, which is, I guess, indicia of punitive nature, is the preclusion that an inmate cannot challenge, once released from the institution, that challenge has to be made before leaving the institution. And oftentimes there's a very short window, small window, and an impossibility. So first of all, is that accurate? And if so, how would you view that?
Okay, two things. First, I apologize. I am at the disadvantage because that's never been briefed. That is not Mr. Jarvis or Mr. Hubbard's situation here today, because they are not long-term serving prisoners. They were newly convicted. They were right on the cusp. They counted as confined because they were being jailed and held for sentencing. If someone has a problem that's procedural, that's a due process violation of I didn't get adequate notice and hearing. Someone who actually is in that situation needs to bring a due process challenge, because if we're making a mistake in giving 2 days versus a week versus two, and if we need to fix something, I will look into that as soon as we get out of this argument. But that is something that someone needs to bring. That doesn't make something retroactive or not. Something is retroactive based on the duty.
But it's like counsel, it would I guess, add to the punitive analysis, the lack of opportunity to challenge. But I understand your response. You'll yield to Ms. Bennington now, is that my understanding?
Sure, I only plan to do five, and I know I usually go over, so Ms. Bennington just froze up, so I'll hand it back to her. And we, of course, ask that you uphold this law because it is milder than what was in effect in Ferguson.
Ms. Bennington?
I would like to quickly address what my friend from the other side said regarding the forfeiture issue. In the lower court, the issue of whether Sierra's law violates Ohio's ban on retroactive law was raised by Mr. Jarvis. So the issue was properly brought before the Fifth District. I know Appellee cites the State v. Gwynn and State v. Quarterman in support of his argument. However, both of those cases are distinguishable because in Gwynn, neither the state nor the defendant raised the issue in the lower court. The appellate court raised it sua sponte. It was later found to be forfeited. And then in Quarterman, the defendant failed to raise the challenge in the trial court, therefore forfeiting the issue. So those cases are distinguishable. That's not what happened here. The issue was properly presented and addressed by the parties before the Fifth District. So the certified issue was not forfeited in this matter. Now, regarding I'd like to correct the claim that Sierra's law is more onerous for several reasons. First, on the features of this.
Well, it looks like we're back in the land of frozen. Mr. Kearney? Do you want to pick up the mantle here?
Sure. This is a, you know, more interesting ball passing back and forth than usual. I'm not sure exactly where Ms. Bennington was going on the particulars of Quarterman. And so I will note that as to forfeiture, it's rather ironic that my friend on the other side is complaining about the degree of preservation by the state on the semantic difference between retroactive or impermissibly retroactive, but then brings a whole new, never before brief, not raised by Mr. Jarvis's facts, claims about people getting out of prison and the due process they're given. So if we're going to hold to what was brought or not brought, or what's raised by these, I would think a goose gander rule should come into effect there to say, well, wait a minute, we can't quite do that. But as to the particular distinctions or comparisons drawn to Adam Walsh, Again, the ones, if you really look at Williams, what the court called out as saying, whether you call it on the cusp, over the line, ooh, only four votes versus five or six in Ferguson. I've never known this court to say a precedent has less weight because it had only four votes instead of six or seven. But the bottom line is that the things the court pointed to as the distinctions jumping from Ferguson to Williams were frequency, scope, and duration of registering every 90 days for life versus only for 10 or 20 years. Here it's every year for 10 years. So by that measure, this is so far less than Ferguson that I really don't see a way to say this is worse than Ferguson, other than a number of features that, again, were already in the Ferguson law. I understand they don't want to take on Ferguson and the decades of Megan's Law because the outcome of that would be devastating throughout our offender system, but there's no logical way to distinguish those. But also the idea that White, this court already in White, re-upped and cited Ferguson, but did not cite Williams. So if Williams did sub silentio move the ball, White has already moved it right back, but they're asking you to move it into a place this court has never been and relieve the registration duties of not only all the murderers. Final thing, since I do see we're out of time now, as you mentioned, well, this has the punitive effect of if you don't comply, you could get convicted of a crime and serve an extra year, and that'll hurt custody or job seeking. I humbly suggest that someone who's done 20 years for murder, having one more year on their record for failure to comply is not really going to change that. And also, that feature was in effect and was even a higher felony in Ferguson than it is here, where it's F5 versus F3 there. So there's no way, again, that could be the distinction. So you need to uphold this law as well as what you've already upheld before. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kearney. Ms. Bennington, you're out of time, so I'm going to tell you all, we'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you. Marshall, will you call a recess?
The court will now adjourn for a brief recess.